Okay.
All right, so I stand near you, just be able to take one with me.
Okay, we're going to just get started really quickly with a roll call.
Okay.
Oh, you got it.
Jennifer Lang.
You got to turn it on.
Here.
Oh, it was on earlier. I thought you turned it on.
Hang on.
You turned it on. Jennifer Lang.
Here.
Ellen Anderson.
Here.
Amy Guinan.
Here.
Dr. Moffitt. I think she's going to call in. Dr. Thacker. Dr. Payne.
Here.
Stan Whitaker.
Here.
Martha Pierce.
Here.
Michael Lockwood. Tracy Inman. Iris Wimbush. Sarah Sequencia.
Do we have anybody? Do we have enough here? Do we have a quorum?
Maybe 10, 4, 4, 1. I think we've got 8.
Okay. Is there anybody on the phone?
William Hightower, Florida Osteopathic Medical Association.
Any members of the committee on the phone?
Cynthia Alpius, member of the HIV/AIDS subcommittee.
Okay. All right. Well, we need 10 members for a quorum. We only have 8, so we won't be making any votes or decisions today unless we have additional members show up on the phone. But I do think that it is important with all the people gathered here today that we do continue with the meeting so that we can disseminate some important information about the program, give some program updates, and give folks an idea of where the program stands right now and just allow for the subcommittees, because we may have quorums on some of the subcommittees, to break out and do some of their business as well. Welcome everyone to Tallahassee. I really appreciate everyone coming here. We're pretty excited to start the new year. Just to give you an update on where our program is during the course of the last year, as you guys know from all of the meetings that we had last year, we were able to roll out very successfully, we believe, the statewide Medicaid managed care program. Both the long-term care, we completed the long-term care component of the rollout, and we completed the managed medical assistance component of the rollout for most populations. Just one major update on January the 1st, the last specialty plan in our program, Freedom Health, which is a specialty plan that serves dual eligibles, people eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid, with chronic conditions like diabetes and COPD. That plan went live in most of the major metropolitan areas of the state successfully on January the 1st. And then we have, in terms of the rollout, the last component will occur on February 1st of this year, and that is that we held out of rollout a number of populations who are in Medicare Advantage organizations. These are people who are dual eligible, fully eligible for Medicaid, but also eligible for Medicare, and they are in Medicare Advantage organizations around the state. And the reason that we held that population out is we wanted to make sure that when they chose their Medicaid health plan, that they had an opportunity to choose the same branded health plan for Medicaid as they have for Medicare. And in order to do that, we had to wait for the Medicare open enrollment period to end and for the people in the Medicare program to choose their Medicare health plan, and then we would try to auto-assign them or match them up with the same branded Medicaid health plan for all of the Medicaid services that they're entitled to, in addition to the bulk of their health care, which is provided through Medicare. That is going to happen, that rollout, that last piece, is going to happen for the elderly population by and large. It's about 100,000 people, about 98,000, was that number? About 98,000 people in Medicare Advantage organizations around the state. There are a lot. There's a pretty high penetration rate for Medicare Advantage organizations in Florida. And those people will go into the managed medical assistance program for their Medicaid wraparound services on February the 1st. Before I go on with some other updates, are there any questions about that, those particular elements?
Should I have
the question was if Ms. Pierce should have received some information about that. I would have to know if you I'd have to know first if you're in a Medicare Advantage organization, not just Medicare, but if you're in a Medicare. Right, he would have already been rolled in then. Only the Medicare Advantage. Oh, but he's DD, right? If he's in the waiver, then he is voluntary for these things. But only people in the Medicare Advantage organization who are mandatory have been held out. They are going in on February the 1st, so it would not apply to your son. Okay? Any other questions on that particular subject? Okay, the other thing that I think is worth updating, there have been a couple of transactions involved in the Medicaid program that touched the Medicaid program in the last several months. I believe on December the 1st, First Coast Advantage, which was one of the plans in the Jacksonville area, what we call our Region 4, Molina Healthcare purchased First Coast Advantage. And so on December the 1st, the First Coast Advantage membership did transition into the Molina Health Plan. As part of that transition, they were given their 90-day rights. They were allowed to switch plans if they did not feel comfortable going into Molina, and they had the opportunity once again to choose one of the health plans that were right for them, or the health plan that was right for them, if they did not feel like Molina was what was right for them. And that transition, by and large, went smoothly as well. There was a process in our contract for if there was a merger or an acquisition, for the parties to notify us well in advance and for us to notify recipients about the change that is coming and to give them a new choice opportunity and then to try to make sure that the transition is as smooth as possible. Happy to say that it did go fairly smoothly. And we have another one coming up as well because Anthem, which is WellPoint, affiliated with Amerigroup, is purchasing three health plans that are in business around the state. Simply Health Plan, which is in Miami, Better Health, which is in Fort Lauderdale and in Tampa, and Clear Health Alliance, which is an HIV-AIDS specialty plan that is virtually in the entire state except for the Jacksonville area. Those three plans have been purchased by Anthem, and we will be working through that with members, making sure that the members understand the change that is about to occur, and that once again, when the change occurs, that they will be given another opportunity to choose a new health plan if that is what they desire. Any questions about the merger and acquisition activity in the program? The Anthem. They've only just notified us. And we are required to have several months of lead time. I forget off the top of my head when it's going to take place. David, is it April? It's late spring, like May the 1st, somewhere there. It's either April 1st or May the 1st. And it's subject to our approval, so they have to go through a number of steps in terms of notification before they would get the go-ahead to do it. But by and large, these types of mergers and acquisitions, they do go relatively smoothly, and we generally try to make it as smooth as possible for the recipients and everyone involved. Yes, I see a question from outside of the committee.
Looking at your chart, try to figure out how many lives involved in First Coast Advantage, zero is an asterisk. Do you know how many lives were involved in those two transactions? How many members approximately?
I would have to look at the numbers for First Coast Advantage estimate. Best estimate, about 65,000 lives in First Coast Advantage.
And on the other one?
Again, the question was how many lives were in First Coast Advantage at the time of the sale. It was at roughly 65,000. The other one you can see there, Better Health has 88,751. Simply has 80,076. And Clear Health Alliance is in the specialty plans. It's the first one listed as 9,073 members. Those three plans have been purchased by Anthem. Okay. Okay. One other piece of business, and I just wanted to let everyone know that our program, we have what's called a Medicaid Management Information System, a contractor that helps us, that runs our information system for us. We have a fiscal agent that helps us pay our bills, that does our decision support system, collects our encounter data, all of those things. It is a contract that we have with HP right now, and it is one that is set to expire in 2018. That may seem like a long way off, but these types of programs and procurements are incredibly complicated, and we are in the process of procuring a new MMIS vendor. There are a lot of different options that are potentially on the table for us in terms of how we do the procurement and what we ask this particular vendor to do. And as part of that process, we have already done a competitive procurement and hired a research vendor to research the options that are available to us in the marketplace. We have also procured a project management firm to help us project manage the procurement. During the course of this spring, as we get advice from the research vendor and as the project manager starts to set up the schedule for doing the new procurement, we will also be doing a procurement for an independent verification and validation, an IVNV vendor. Did I get those backwards? The V's stand for something like that. We'll be doing that procurement during the course of the spring, and we anticipate that our new MMIS invitation to negotiate or request for proposals, the procurement vehicle that we use, we haven't decided yet, but whatever we do to try to do the procurement, whatever vehicle, that it will hit the street sometime in the middle of next calendar year, probably around July the 1st, sometime in July. That would be the guess. This calendar year. Yes, sorry. 2015. I apologize. This calendar year. Do we have any questions about that one? Stan. You recognize it. Well, the functionality is something that we are going to be. The question is whether that is purely statistical or purely financial, or whether there's some statistical angles to it as well. We need to understand from our research vendor what is out there. One of the things that the federal government has pushed for in this type of procurement is that the systems become more and more modular, and we need to think about how many different vendors we want to procure. Right now, the vendor that we have, HP, does run our decision support system, and they do also pay our bills for us. They pay our claims for us and help us with provider enrollment and other things. And one of the things that we have to think about as we do the re-procurement is, do we want one entity to do all of those things, or do we want separate procurements and maybe some a systems integrator or something like that that helps us stitch the pieces together? We need to make sure that we talk with our federal partner about this. We need to make sure we talk with our research vendor about this and understand all of the options out there so that we can get the best value for the people of the state of Florida. Stan, follow up.
My question would be is this. We tried to get research data on MPs from the database that we currently have. And it's a very difficult process that we have to go through to get that research data. I mean, everybody was nice and collected, but as far as MPs are concerned, there's not really a direct way to measure them in the Medicaid program, just that subgroup. So when you are looking at this modular program that's moving out, are we going to look at these subgroups as far as tracking what they're doing, that sort of thing, or are we just going to lump providers into a big pool and say, here we go?
There was a question about, really generally, about the functionality and how fine a search mechanism there would be in it, and whether you could do, for example, queries and searches around nurse practitioners to get specific data to nurse practitioners. We would intend that you could do that in our system. And we do need to understand from our current advisors, the research vendor and others, what is out there. The idea would be that we would have a system that would make that type of search easier and easier. That type of query could be run and could be run very easily. And we just have to understand what's out there as we try to procure the system. Currently, you can do those queries, as you mentioned, but as you get into data issues with a program as large and complex as this one, what you start to understand is that it really makes a difference when you do the query, how you enter the query, If two different people aren't extracting the exact, putting the exact same query into the system at the exact same time for the exact same time frame in the exact same way, you could get two different answers to the same question. And as you come, as you develop your systems and then you develop protocols around how you ask questions of the system, you have to try to be very, I don't want to say prescriptive, but people need to be very careful that they're always pulling the same information from the same data sources in the same way at regular intervals and around at regular time frames so that you really can make comparisons and track how the program's doing and how expenditures are going, how many services are being provided, things like that. Because if you do ask the questions differently and you don't, you're not querying the exact same information from the exact same data sources, you will get very different answers from our current system. And I think that's probably what you ran into when you made the queries before.
Yes. So, back to my question, are we looking at making data retrieval a bit easier than the new system that's coming forward?
The question was whether we're looking at making the new system, the data more easily retrievable. And the answer is yes. So we want to update the system and make it best in class. So we want to have a best in class system. And we want to take advantage of the fact that the last system was procured in the middle of the last decade, 2007-2008. A lot has happened since then in the world of technology. It's one of the areas in the country that moves the fastest. And we want to take advantage of the developments over the last 10 years. And we want to end up with a system that is not only modern at the time that we procure it and implement it, but also one that is scalable and that can be updated regularly and that stays on the cutting edge and doesn't fall behind. Dr. Payne.
Yes, Robert Payne. Just a point of order. As a courtesy to those on the conference call, if someone would speak, identify themselves so the people on the conference call knew who was talking.
Oh, sure. Okay, Chris Snow asking a question from the audience.
And I know you have other vendors, you know, assuming HP doesn't get it again or whoever, you know, that they would be required to run, say, for a couple months, say the contract changes over July 1st, maybe April and May, run concurrently, kind of a trial, so they could kind of teach their folks and learn how to do it before they're actually required to be responsible for people getting paid on time. Is that something you could consider is really all I'm throwing out there?
That is definitely something that we will consider, and this is going to happen in 2018, and it's very important that there be a transition plan that is put in place that allows us to do a transition from one MMIS system, one MMIS vendor to another, in as smooth a manner as possible. There are a number of different options on the table for us. One is that that the new vendor, if there is one, takes over the old system, because we own the old system, HP does not, or the current system, HP does not. And if it's HP taking over HP's the current system, it's probably going to be a very smooth transition, and we would expect modular updates perhaps over the course of time to get the system up to date. I mean, there's just a lot of different things that we can choose from. Do we want just a takeover of the current system by whoever the new vendor happens to be, or maybe HP? Do we want an entirely new system, either from HP or from a new vendor? Do we want to mix and match and have some modules be brand new and other modules be continued? These are the types of things that we're discussing with our research vendor and the types of things that we need to understand about the marketplace out there for this type of management information system. As far as the transition goes, we would work to make sure that the transition was as smooth as possible and that providers had an opportunity to understand the new system as we implement it. I was not here for the beginning of the last one. I I know some stories about the last transition from one vendor to another. My wife at the time was a Medicaid provider, and I heard it, and we're certainly hoping that the next one will go smoother than that.
And just thinking kind of from my MBA head right now, you also have a lot of attrition from the group that's leaving, assuming HP doesn't get it. And maybe they're going over to the other company because they know what they're doing and they want a job. But it'd be great even if it would just not, even if it was just like interactive implementation of it, if they could kind of work together so we would still get paid during the last few months of the transition, but also have people ready, that whole, you know, anyway, just something. Appreciate your thoughts on it.
Sure. Again, we'll work as hard as we can to make sure that the transition goes as smooth as possible. And obviously, it's incredibly important to us that providers are paid for the services that they render. The number of claims that are paid fee-for-service in our system is actually substantially reduced at this point, and promises to be even more significantly reduced probably by 2018. That being said, it's still important for us for encounter claims to come in for rate setting and things like that, and we will probably still have some residual fee for service in the system in 2018, and providers need to be paid and paid promptly for the services that they render. In fact, there's a whole series of federal laws around that you have to pay 90% of your clean claims within 30 days, 99% within 90 days, and 100% within a year. Yeah. Okay, the last thing, just a piece of news from the agency, and that is that Secretary Dudek has been asked to stay on by the governor and has been reappointed as Secretary of the agency. She's going to be going through the confirmation process in the Senate, and for all of us here on the agency management team, we're very happy about that, and I just wanted to make sure that everybody was aware that Secretary Dudek has been reappointed. So with that, I will turn it over to Beth Kidder for some additional updates.
Okay, good afternoon. I also have a series of updates. First off, I wanted to talk a little bit about the health plan report card. Many of you participated in the webinar where we talked about the health plan report card, which has been under development. You gave your feedback, had opportunities to comment on the draft design of that. The purpose of this is to have a consumer-friendly way of presenting information about the performance of our health plans. We consider this to be a starting point for measuring quality. The kinds of things that will be in there are only, at this point, HEDIS measures, which are national standardized measures that are also measured for many Medicaid health plans across the nation, so we can benchmark against like plans in other states and around the nation. So that's what we're starting with. We appreciate all the feedback that we got. The design is being finalized, and we should be seeing it very soon. It will be posted on our Florida Health Finder .gov website, which is a wealth of consumer information. We have also made some other changes on FloridaHealthFinder.gov to conform the Medicare and commercial plan ratings to the same scale that we're using for Medicaid, so that so there's some comparability looking across plans across different lines of business. So that'll be coming soon, and there will be an announcement made when it comes out, so folks will know that has happened. So look for that coming soon. So again, thank you all for your feedback on that. Any questions?
Thanks, Beth. I think we might have talked about this briefly when we had our big presentation. Oh, I apologize. This is Amy Guinan with Florida Legal Services. I'm curious. I know you just mentioned that it's going to be posted, the report card's going to be posted on Health Finder, but I think that there's a lot of valuable information on the SMMC section of the website. I know that's where recipients, providers can make complaints, and there's a lot of good material in the question and answers. So I think it would be really important for the postcards, that won't be based there, at least to have some sort of link so that when consumers are going there for information, they can quickly link to the report cards.
Yes, and thank you for bringing that up. I didn't. There will be links from other places. So there will be links from the agency's website as well as from our Choice Counseling vendor site, because we really do want consumers to be looking at the quality of the health plans, the quality of their health outcomes when they're making decisions about which plan they want to be in. So, yes, there will be links from other places, and if you have suggestions of other places that can be linked. We also allow others to link to our site from their website. So we have no problem with getting the word out on this. Okay, the second thing is just to give you a little bit of feedback on the comprehensive quality strategy. In our meeting, I believe in October, we went over the comprehensive quality strategy. The subgroups discussed it and gave feedback. We have turned that into Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. We did that at the end of October. And we're expecting word back from CMS any day now on whether they think that there are any revisions that are needed to that. So, again, we'll keep you posted as that's accepted. The draft is out there on our website if you want to see what we submitted to CMS, and then once it's finalized, it'll be replaced by the final version. Okay. Then I just have two more updates for you. All of our Medicaid coverage handbooks are undergoing review right now for a number of reasons, but primarily because of managed care. We want to make sure that the way that they're written makes sense in a primarily managed care environment. And as you see them come out through the normal rulemaking process, you will see them look quite different than they have in the past. Not just the formatting, but they will be much more streamlined, much simpler. There will be fewer requirements in there for providers. And again, we are stripping it down to the essential things that we think are critical for providers to know in order to be able to be a provider, to be able to bill. And we really want the feedback of the public in this, so it goes through the public rulemaking process, and we welcome everybody's participation in those handbooks. We have 45 different provider type handbooks and service handbooks that are out there, as well as fee schedules, which are also undergoing more minor revisions. The policy handbooks are the much more substantive ones. So I just want to make you aware of that when you see them, they will look different. Some of them are already out there, so if you're a regular participant in our rule process, you may have already seen what the new format looks like. But we welcome your feedback, and we really want everybody to be involved in that process. That does set the baseline for what we cover not only in fee-for-service, but under managed care as well. So. Okay. And then, again, two more updates. Many of you have been involved over the years in issues around non-emergency transportation, and you know that for the last 10 years we've contracted with the Commission for Transportation Disadvantage to handle transportation services for people who don't have another way to get to Medicaid-covered services. And they have coordinated that through a series of contracts at the county level to get transportation provided. Our contract with them is coming to its natural end at the end of February, and they have exercised their option to not continue that contract. So we are working with three vendors right now to contract to handle those services for the people who are remaining in fee-for-service and who need transportation services. I think most of you know that the managed care organizations are required to handle the transportation for their members. So, again, this is just for the fee-for-service group, and we will be working with several vendors to cover the rest of the state for the non-emergency transportation. Yes, Ellen Anderson with Florida Hospital Association.
How does that work with disabled kids? Like if they are discharged from the hospital or if they're on a ventilator or anything, is that CMS that does that?
It depends where their coverage is. If they're in Children's Medical Services, Children's Medical Services handles their transportation. If they're in any managed care plan, that managed care plan handles their transportation. If they are a child or an adult that's in the fee-for-service part of Medicaid, then that's going to be handled by one of these vendors that that we're working to contract with.
And that'll be seamless, I imagine, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Recipients will be notified of the change or in the process of being notified of that change of vendors and who they would need to call for transportation. Just a minute, please, from the audience.
Thank you. This is John Moore. I just had a clarifying question on the transportation issue. Is it contemplated that you'll have, in effect, another vendor that will cover the statewide as you described the previous situation, or are you dealing with vendors and will divide up the state, or is there some other construct?
We're looking at a regional division of the state among several vendors.
Thank you.
Okay, and then the last thing I wanted to mention is a new report that will be coming out soon on about our managed care program. This one it's going to be part of a series that we do on a regular basis, reporting on what we can learn from our data, from statistics, from our reviews of our managed care plans, and they're designed to shine a light on what's going on with our managed care plans to promote transparency in the program. And these will be put out on a regular basis from our business intelligence unit, which was created for the purpose of helping us with managed care and moving us forward with some of the kinds of data issues that have been mentioned. This one in particular will focus on the long-term care program because it is the portion of statewide Medicaid managed care that's been in effect for the longest. It rolled out between August of 2013 and March of 2014. So we are at the point where it's been operating fully across the state for almost a year now, and there are some data that are available that we felt were strong enough to be released. So there's some interesting information in there. I hope you all will take a look at it when it comes out. Give us feedback on it, whether this is the kind of information that you're interested in. I'm sure we'll be presenting on it at the next Medical Care Advisory Committee meeting and be able to get your feedback. The group that's working on it is very interested in knowing what kinds of questions people have that they could perhaps help answer through data. So that's it for me. Thank you. Question from Amy.
Amy Guinan with Florida Legal Services again. Just to go back real quickly to the Medicaid coverage handbook update that you all are going through, do you have a goal date in mind for when that process is going to be complete?
We hope to have all of them through the rule process in 2 years, and so we're in the first year. We're sort of on a fiscal year basis. We hope to have about half of them in process by the end of this fiscal year, and then complete the rest of them the following year.
And like in cases where like the SIP handbook, I don't think there is a handbook, not even up to date. That there isn't even one in existence yet. So we'll like in cases like that for those coverages basically be prioritized over the ones that have been revised in the last couple of years?
I would have to check on that particular one to see where it is. Obviously, where we don't have a rule in place, we've been working on it with SIP in particular for a long time. I think those are already in progress, but I could check and see where
okay.
that one is particularly.
Great. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much.
Now, next on the agenda, we are going to turn it over to Jennifer Lang from the Department of Children and Families, who is going to give us an update on the open enrollment experience in the federally facilitated marketplace. Go ahead, Jenny.
Thank you. Given the timing of this meeting, I thought there might be some interest in what was happening with the transfers from the federal marketplace. And just for the record, this is the second year of open enrollment into that process by which people get the tax credits for their health care. And last year, the open enrollment period ran from October 1st to March 31st. So it was 6 months long last year. This year, it runs from November the 15th to February the 15th. Applications for Medicaid flow between the states and the federal marketplace all year long because there is no open enrollment for Medicaid, just for the tax credit programs. And the way it works is that the tax subsidies, Medicaid, and the Children's Health Insurance Program move data and move accounts around all during the year because an application for one is an application for the other. And last year, people knew there were some delays at the federal level in getting that process working. So last year we got a huge influx of referrals in March, and then we got a chunk, about 36,000 in April, and it started to flatten out. After the open enrollment ended, we were going about 5,000 transfers a month from the marketplace. As of November, when they opened up the second open enrollment period, that as expected, spiked again, about 19,000 in November. As of the writing of this document at the end of December, we were at about 42,000 for December. As of last weekend, we were up to a little over 70,000 all total. Of those, we've processed about 56,000. We've got about 15,000 that are still pending. They're still coming in every day, but basically it's going kind of like we expected that it would, and we're moving them through. Little less, if you do the math for January than we had in December. We were expecting that because of the rule that if you applied by December 15th, you could get into a marketplace plan for January. So it's tapered off, at least, you know, at the moment, a little bit since then. But we'll keep taking, the federal marketplace will keep taking their applications through February 15th and sending us accounts. So far, of those that we've processed, we've enrolled about 67,000 people in Medicaid. And it's going pretty well. Any questions?
Ellen. Ellen Anderson, Florida Hospital Association.
Thanks. Hi. So when you do the transfer, do you get a confirmation as to whether or not they enrolled in the marketplace, or is that something that just goes to the feds and they track it?
When we get a transfer, it means that they've said no to marketplace benefits, and they have screened them as potentially eligible for Medicaid and are forwarding it to us for a decision on the Medicaid.
Yeah. We're what's known as an assessment state, so they have assessed the person. They don't believe that they're eligible for any policies on the federally subsidized policies on the exchange, but the determination, the determination is then made by the Department of Children and Families, so they turn the file over, transfer the file to the Department of Children and Families to make a determination as to whether or not they're Medicaid eligible. Dr. Payne.
Robert Payne with the FDA. Two questions for Jennifer, mostly informational. What is the current Medicaid enrollment in the state of Florida, and do you see that number trending upward?
I didn't bring it, but Justin, aren't we at about 3.3 million?
We are between 3.7 and 3.8 million Medicaid recipients. Of those, 400,000 plus would be dual eligible for Medicare and Medicaid, and not fully dual. They'd be partial duals, which means that they get their health care through the Medicare program, and we only pay for co-payments and premium assistance and things like that. We don't pay for services. So it's 3.3 that would be fully eligible for benefits in our program and would actually receive benefits, and another 400,000 or 500,000 that would be eligible for some premium assistance in the Medicare program from us.
Now, has this number been growing?
Yes.
Okay. And the next question, for someone to be eligible for a subsidy or a rebate under fairly facilitated marketplace, it's tied into the federal poverty level. Is it like three times the federal poverty level?
I believe it's four.
Four times?
If the higher you are toward 400, the less of a subsidy you'd receive. The lower you are toward about 100, the higher the subsidy you'd receive.
Okay, so it's probably the subsidy is at 100% when you're at one at the federal poverty level, and then it decreases to zero when you get past four.
I don't know the exact numbers, but the subsidies are significantly higher if you're 105% of federal poverty, and then they would be significantly lower if you're 395%.
Okay. And for a family of four, what is the federal poverty level?
I didn't bring it, but I think it's about 23. Does that sound right, Amy?
Okay. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
One more question from Amy Guinan from Florida Legal Services.
Hey. one new expanded coverage area that we've been very concerned about under the ACA, and I know, Jennifer, you and I have talked about this, is the Medicaid coverage for former foster youth, that they're eligible now for Medicaid until they're 26. And I know we've been working with the department about actually identifying those former foster youth until they're 21, when the CBCs still have contact with them. But we're still concerned about the former foster youth, 22 to 26, who are eligible and just aren't aware that they're eligible. And I know during the last enrollment period, we actually encouraged those former foster youth to apply through DCF and Access rather than going through the marketplace due to the delays. I was wondering, this time around, have you been able to track former foster youth, or can you see if they're going through the marketplace and then being transferred to you, or are they still applying more through Access?
Yes, we're tracking them. We some of them we know where they are, or we have a recent address on them, and some of them we don't. We sent correspondence to those we had a good address for, encouraging them to apply if they wanted to, and we're working with the CBCs and our child and care staff to make sure people know and they know how to apply. And if they're under 21, you know, typically they don't need to apply. We can just work with that.
A follow-up? But for the ones who are over 21 and you're able to contact them, do you encourage them to apply through the marketplace or through Access?
We encourage them to apply at our website, but they can apply at the other.
And were you able to see where the numbers higher than last year that came through the federal marketplace?
I think one of the issues is it's Medicaid, so they don't need to wait for open enrollment. They can apply year-round with either us or the marketplace.
Okay. We will go ahead and move on to the next item on the agenda. We'll be welcoming David Rogers from the Agency for Healthcare Administration, who's going to give us an update on the Centralized Complaint and Issue Hub. As many of you know, we've rolled out this new program, the Statewide Medicaid Managed Care Program, and as part of the process of consolidating a number of different programs, our reform waiver, our non-reform managed care waiver, our MediPass program, our fee-for-service system, all of the different long-term care waivers that we are running before. As part of the consolidation of those into one program, we have consolidated and centralized our issue and complaint intake process so that the complaints and any registration of dissatisfaction or expression of dissatisfaction can come into one area where they can be aggregated and tracked and trended, and we can quickly try to remedy any problems that are coming up in the program. So to give us an update on the issue hub, here's David Rogers.
Great. Thank you. You should have received some information in your packet for this meeting. I think this is a monthly complaint report, and what I want to do today is just give you a bit of context, but then kind of walk you through the orientation of the report. This is something that we plan to produce on a monthly basis going forward, so I wanted you to kind of understand what you're looking at. So we'll spend some time and have some dialogue about how we'll use that kind of going forward. But first, let me just give you a little bit of context around the origin. So we developed a data system for the implementation of the Medicaid reform pilot in 2006. To capture complaints. And we began to explore in early 2013 the feasibility of using that system to monitor implementation. We did that with the implementation of the statewide prepaid dental health program. And that led us to do a couple things, including creating the centralized process and staffing that Justin talked about so that we would have kind of consistent data entry. Previously, the data, you know, kind of was all put in different places around different units, and that was made it very challenging because it kind of people handled that with some bit of variation. And then also, so that we'd have real-time entry and access to information real-time, we found that we kind of went through that, you know, there was a lag time generally between someone called and, you know, registered an issue, that I have an issue, and when it got into the system. So we wanted, as we went through rollout, to be able to see it, obviously, rapidly so that we could respond to any issues. So we developed a complaint hub. for that purpose, to kind of monitor on a rapid cycle basis through implementation. We really didn't develop it, you know, as a compliance tool as much as, again, a QA process through the implementation. One of the things you'll notice on the report is we refer to this as issues and not complaints. It doesn't have to be a valid complaint, as one might think of it in the, you know, kind of the licensure context. As Justin said, it's really we're picking up expressions of dissatisfaction. So if someone, you know, calls and says, I don't like the color of my ID card I got from the plan, it's likely to show up probably as a customer service issue when we get here. Again, it doesn't have to be valid. We've had complaints, for example, a billing complaint where a provider, understandably rather disturbed, had denied claims from a plan. Through the research, the individual, the recipient that the provider was billing for was enrolled in a different plan, not the plan that was being billed. So again, these are issues that people are having. We build a process to really help recipients and providers transition through the implementation was kind of our primary purpose and kind of putting this structure in place. In fact, as you know, everywhere we went, we really tried to promote this process. We did develop a web form so that to try to make it easier for people to get information in, and we did get information in. But it would, you know, as I said, it could be issues or any kind of concerns. We in fact solicited concerns, as I think we've talked about before, did outbound calls on both long-term care and other special populations. Again, we really weren't looking for a kind of statistical reporting tool as much as a process to facilitate the individual resolution of cases. So what we looked at on a daily basis when we started with implementation was really what came in the previous day, which was largely narrative form, which was really interesting because it could be very short, hey, I need some assistance. It could be, somebody's life story kind of. It could be, if it came through the web particularly, it could be very raw. You know, you were all crazy. You know, just it was going through there and trying to identify the issue, having people respond right away, clarify, get additional information. And part of the reason I raise that is because what you'll see is we tried to classify that, a couple things. It's very difficult to do within the system that we have, and also this is what's initially reported. So we often find that as we research, you know, initially and work with an individual recipient or provider to resolve the issue, that the issues kind of move around a little bit. So what we're going to talk about is the initial kind of report and how they're classified. But it's a lot of work to get, you know, to kind of get some meaningful analysis and generally do that on an ad hoc basis. I will say before we kind of look at these numbers that that we did use the kind of the overall numbers to track our progress during implementation. So we could see, for example, at the start of the fiscal year that we got about 200 roughly, you know, issues coming in a week. We're now down to about 100, give or take, on a weekly basis, a little short of that this past week because probably the holidays still. But so that tracks also with our overall call volume has dropped. About a half of the first half of this fiscal year. So that kind of what you would expect during the implementation period. So with that being said, this is a monthly report for December. Kind of got three pages to it. The first is some plan-specific information, kind of high level. Then we'll go to some more detail on the back, and then there's a definition page with some caveats also as the third page. And mine's nice and easy. You can kind of split them out to look at. The what we do on the first page is we have all the plans listed. They're grouped by our general, sometimes what are called standard plans, those plans providing acute care to the overall population. And then we have the specialty plans broken out separately, kind of put them together. And so each plan is listed. We also have a category for non-plan specific or general issues, and I'll highlight a couple of those. Again, not an issue, an issue that's not specific to a plan. If someone calls and has an issue or a complaint with multiple plans, it gets captured under all the different plans. That's how we kind of handle that. We'll actually raise it to you. Chris, you have a question?
Yeah. Chris Snow with the Alliance for Pediatric Therapy.
The second plan is Children's Medical Services, which my understanding had been that the north part of Florida, that's what we knew as Children's Medical Services, had contracted with PDICare, whatever. So I'm just confused on the names, and maybe I don't understand it correctly, so if you could clarify.
Just to give you some clarification, South Florida Community Care Network is a general plan. It's a plan that's available to residents of Broward County who are in the Medicaid program. It also is a subcontractor to Children's Medical Services that helps them put their network together and to provide services in the southern part of the state. But Children's Medical Services, as it's listed here, any complaint that comes in from an enrollee or a provider regarding Children's Medical Services, whether it has to do with the southern part of the state or the northern part of the state, is registered as a complaint or an expression of dissatisfaction regarding Children's Medical Services. If it is an enrollee or a provider that is having difficulty with South Florida Community Care Network's general plan in Broward County, then it's registered as an expression of dissatisfaction with the general plan in Broward County.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead. Thank you, Justin. So in Ensign Porter, we have the number of enrollees actually listed in the next column to the right. So with each plan, so that you see the number of enrollees. That's very important as you get to the next two columns, where you're looking at both the number of issues that we've received, the agency has received in the last 90 days, and the number for the report month. Okay, so both kind of looking back over 90 days and for this current month. We then use a metric that's pretty important, I think, in terms of looking at this in relationship to all the different plans. We look at the number of issues per 1,000 enrollees. So it kind of equalizes the metric across the different, the varying enrollment amounts for plans. Okay, so that you can kind of compare what the different levels are that way. So just to kind of highlight that calculation. So we'll just take the first line, just because it's the first line in the Mira group. It's at 0.11 per 1,000. That's just over one complaint for every 10,000 members that are enrolled in the plan. Okay. So that, again, that's kind of a metric that we use to normalize on the volume coming in on a monthly basis. We also look at the difference here. You can see the next column, which is kind of which way is it going from that 90-day period. Is that metric going up or down? And then we kind of jump into the resolution timeframes. And that is broken down by beneficiary issues and provider issues. And let me make a couple of points. You'll see almost across the board that the provider issues are generally take longer. And then let me kind of bracket the time frame. We've actually had a good bit of discussion with plans about this because of the way we measure that. It's actually the time frame there is from the date that the agency receives it until the agency follows up and determines that that issue was satisfactorily resolved. Okay. So there's a little bit, at least a day, generally a day lead time on the front end before a plan would receive it from the agency and start working on it. And then oftentimes it may take us a day or two or sometimes three to follow up with an individual to see if, if the issue was resolved. So we count the whole time. This is really kind of for us to look at the time frame. And in that, you'll see it, the recipient are always a little bit, or excuse me, the providers are a little bit more lengthy than the recipients.
I'll just interject. Again, this is all expressions of dissatisfaction. When we say satisfactorily resolved, one example, real example, is where a provider was calling up and saying that they were billing United and United was not paying them for the services that they rendered. When we studied the issue, what we found is that the enrollee was not enrolled in United. They were enrolled in Sunshine. Now, I don't know how satisfied the provider was with that resolution, but we had done as much as we could, and we connected the person with Sunshine and tried to give them the opportunity to bill Sunshine, but they were billing the wrong plan. Not every one of these expressions of dissatisfaction turns out to be a substantiated issue. There are times when it becomes apparent that it's a very easy fix. Maybe it's a misunderstanding about the program, and we can help the person. I just wanted to interject that.
Okay. Great.
I'll recognize Ellen Anderson from the Florida Hospital Association for a question.
I just
What's the difference between a beneficiary issue versus a provider issue?
Provider issue typically has to do, there's two main things we might want to jump here to the back in a minute.
If you can, we'll kind of
break down the issues. We tried to cluster it for you. The last two columns are just the issues resolved in the reporting period in the last 30 days, and then the number of issues at the present time that are still pending resolution that we haven't closed the loop, as Justin described.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you go to the back, it's a little bit more detail. And again, what we've tried to do is kind of break these down into different kind of groupings that might make some sense of how to look at them. These are generally classified how they're reported. Again, how an individual might present their issue to the agency, whether that turns out to be the issue or not. So as we work through that, if you look at the provider issues, Ella, that's what I wanted to kind of pull you to this page, right? The two main things are provider enrollment and claims payment. Provider enrollment, particularly as we were kind of going into the rollout and early, while providers were going through contracting and credentialing, something that we saw much more frequently than we do now. There's 10 issues out there now. Payment, probably as we hit the initial or the completion of the rollout in August, September, October, we saw that really kind of stand up as the top issue and kind of represents, what, about a quarter plus of 30% probably of the issues, all the issues that are reported to the agency or the agency receives. So we've taken this level of detail and kind of tried to break that out by plan in terms of the service delivery issues, again, network adequacy issues, the provider issues that we talked about, recipient enrollment issues that were, again, because we were encouraging people to call, we had a lot of calls that Justin talked about. People just didn't understand the program. They weren't sure what to do, and they got mail, and they called us. So we had a lot of, choice counseling issues and plan changes during the, the initial 90-day period when individuals could change plans. County code errors was actually one that was new, that's kind of a new thing for us in terms of reform that came up in long-term care. So we did have some flexibility to add. That was an issue that we actually learned through the complaint process that was a problem for people when they were in a county that was unknown to us in the system. Right, we had them registered in a different county, and the way we did enrollment, particularly in long-term care, where they could have been enrolled in a plan, but they lived in a different county. And so we had to develop a whole process to be able to work with the department and make the appropriate changes to the files, both in the access system and in the Medicaid system when we found that situation to occur. Again, it happened. You can see, I think there was one this month. You can imagine when we went through the whole rollout, we had obviously significantly more volume. But it's important that we develop the process for even the one or the two that might happen on an ongoing basis where we have that disconnect in the information. General customer service issues, again, that have I think we saw more issues, more call volume in this area as we went through the rollout probably. And then other issues that we have identified as a couple of specialized tracks, so aggressive marketing. We allow plans to market under the new SMNC contract. We had gone very slow in putting that on the ground until we could build the infrastructure to do the oversight. So we've created some specialized processes there. And then any allegation of inappropriate use of PHI, or any allegation of fraud. And when I talk about these special processes, what we're doing and where this system helped us in having the hub, the ability to kind of capture these quickly and move them out, as Justin mentioned, we've gone through a reorganization where we're now structured functionally that we can move these issues to the right place. So if we have quality of care issues, which can be really varied, but that we can move them to our quality bureau with folks who are in a clinical consultation unit, wherever appropriate, so the right people have the ability to look at them, that we have a network compliance unit, that we can move any allegation that someone can't access, can move it there so they can make sure that they're looking at the networks and working with the plans. We developed a brand new claims oversight unit in Fort Lauderdale where all these provider payment claims go, right? So where that helps us too is that the people that we have consistent people that are seeing the issue, unlike when we were kind of geographically structured, and we might have had the same issue that showed up in different parts of the state, but we couldn't really see it as being a bigger issue. We now have them all going, you know, kind of to the same place, so that we can see it, and those people have kind of the responsibility for working it through and fixing the issue. And that's also linked, I should say, to our compliance or our plan management function. So I'll give you use the claims example. So a lot of times it is. You know, the need for some training, some technical assistance, just some information, you know, or just some communication between the plan and the provider. And we kind of facilitate that. The agency staff will work to get them connected, to make sure they're talking and dealing with the problems, to get the information, get the claims paid. Sometimes we find an issue. If the plan has failed to meet its contractual obligation, that particular group of folks that are working these issues will connect with our plan management, our contract compliance folks, to take appropriate contract action and to the plan where we found the plan's not meeting those contractual obligations. So with that, I'll kind of stop, ask for any questions, and we'll kind of take it from there. Okay. Dr. Thacker.
Dr. Thacker, you're recognized.
Welcome. So thank you very much. Rich Thacker, internist, working here locally, and I apologize for coming in a little late, but I've got the gist of everything here, and it was a good presentation. And I like the format that you have. It's easy to read and pick up some information. I've got some particular questions, though. But first I'll say just a quick statement. Let's not lose fact when we're talking about numbers that raw numbers represent people to me, and percentages don't represent as much to me. And the reason I say it sort of like that and in this format is that, case in point, and I hate that I'm picking on somebody, you know, or one particular plan, but let's look at Staywell being, you know, the largest plan, and has a very small percentage, you know, in terms of overall complaints, but has the highest raw number. So in my mind, you know, as the people person, the point of care contact doctor, one patient at a time. And so that's the largest overall raw number of complaints. And so even though the percentage is low, they have the biggest problem in my mind. Okay, and that's just kind of how I'm viewing it a little bit from a different take.
Can I address that? Before we go on.
Sure.
It's something that I've certainly noticed in the Medicaid program, and I've noticed it in the coverage of our program. It's a very large program. We deal with a lot of people, and we deal with a lot of money, billions of dollars. One thing that I've noticed in our coverage, and it's why the information is presented this way, is that if someone wants to maximize a problem, they'll put the raw number and the dollar value down. Because even things that are an entire, very, very small as a percentage in terms of expenditures, $5 million is a very large amount of money, is an extremely low percentage of the budget of our program. If someone is trying to minimize a problem, they only put the percentage. And so as we discussed how to present this information, I said that we do not want to minimize it and we don't want to maximize it. We want to show both looks, so that people have full data, and they can use that data to minimize it or maximize it as they see fit. But we're not going to be working with the data that way. We're going to present it every way we can. And so, you know, I actually just to also a point, I think Humana and Prestige both had higher raw numbers than WellCare and StayWell, just to be fair to them. But you're right, they had one of the higher totals, but we wanted to make sure that in addition to presenting the raw number, to be fair, we also presented the percentage so that people could understand that how common it was for a member of StayWell to complain about, to have a register some dissatisfaction with respect to StayWell.
Totally agree. I was just referring to the second column, number of issues received in the last 90 days.
I'm sorry, I was looking at the last 30 days. You're correct.
Yeah. The so then some more specific questions, I guess, in regards to the reporting. When we look at raw numbers, and I realize you got different issues broken down, but from a provider's standpoint, if a provider's office calls and they have the same issue with 10 different enrollees, is that one call, one issue on the provider, or is it 10 different? Does that go into number 10 under the raw numbers, even though it's the same problem? It's just 10 different beneficiaries originating from one office.
If it comes in from a provider, I'm going to have to check this. I think it would, for one plan, 10 recipients for one plan, if it was a billing issue, it would show up as one issue.
So you see how that'll skew your numbers, so we need to clarify that and probably tease that out a little bit.
I think so. And again, as I said, we really developed this as a process to facilitate, provide assistance during the transition. The trick for us is to probably, to keep working on, particularly the processes for linking to these functional units. If it's a issue about the care for the recipient, it would show up for each recipient. If it was a billing problem and 10 recipients with multiple plans, it would show up in however many plans. Again, it's structured in a way that's designed to facilitate working to resolve that particular issue.
And I agree with that. Resolution is the goal. But in terms of these numbers and all of the work and everything you're putting into that, if you don't have that clarified and teased out, it dilutes your report a little bit and makes it just slightly suspect on certain things at certain times, maybe in the future. So if you clarify that, that'd be great. If providers... let's say you have it broken down on the second page where we have one section that is just provider issues. Then we have, different categories, service delivery issues, network access, peripheral enrollment, customer services, so forth. So can a provider who calls in have an issue under service delivery or network access and so forth?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And so it becomes a little, in terms, and I'm not trying to make it too hard, but once again, I mean, it's a good report.
Just so you have an understanding, you as a provider are allowed to enter a complaint or an expression of dissatisfaction on behalf of one of your patients. And if you did it for multiple patients, again, each one would be counted, as David was saying, as a separate recipient complaint. And if you had a billing issue with a plan and you were saying, I'm not getting paid, that would be counted as one issue. It might be a number of different claims, but we're trying to resolve the issue of you not getting paid by that one plan. Now, if it's multiple plans, you're going to get – there's multiple problems that we're going to have to address there that we registered across the plans. But I just want to make it clear, and it doesn't – it's not just as a provider. As providers, you can do it. You could do it. Florida Legal Services can do it on behalf of its recipients. The Florida Hospital Association, its members can do it. You can put in a complaint or an expression of dissatisfaction on behalf of a patient or on behalf of a client. I just want everybody to understand that. We don't want – really, don't sit on problems is my message there. Really help us to resolve issues and help us to identify issues that are broader and feel very comfortable doing that. It can be done anonymously as well, if the recipient or if the provider doesn't want to be named. I don't know. There may be reasons why they don't want to be, but that is fine as well. You can leave the name blank, and we can get an anonymous tip. Ellen, you're recognized. Ellen Anderson from the Florida Hospital Association. And we will get back to you, Dr. Thacker. I know you have more. You have more to say.
Stan Whitaker with the Florida Association of Nurse Practitioners. Speaking to that issue, if I have an issue with a recipient that needs to be referred, and I go through the plans and they don't get referred, there's not a provider, and I file a complaint, and then it comes back and says, well, they're working on it. Is that the end of that issue? Or, number one, there's a couple questions I want to ask. Because a complaint hub gets back and says, oh, well, they're working on that. They're trying to get somebody for you. Okay, fine. So, you know, we call back and nothing gets resolved, so we file another complaint that says, you know, we're still trying to refer this patient. The provider that they suggested that we use will not accept the patient, will not accept this plan's, you know, reimbursal or for whatever, and so we are trying to refer them out again. And this is an actual case, by the way.
Refer them to, where are you referring them to?
We're referring them to a specialist.
Okay.
Okay? So we're going from a PCP to a specialist. Okay? So now we've moved out of region into a different region, specifically 500-mile area, and finally wind up trying to get this person in with a specialist, it takes 4 months.
Okay. We'd have to look if, and I don't know why that issue wasn't resolved to the recipient satisfaction. We'd have to take a look at it. Contract does require that you be able to make an appointment with a specialist within 60 days. So if that particular plan was having trouble with that is a situation where we can take a contract action against the plan for failure to coordinate that care.
Now, when this is reported to the hub, and the hub gets with the plan, and they say, we talked with the plan, you know, they're working on this sort of thing, is there a appeal process past that member of the hub that says, you know, guys, I really appreciate you looking into this, but I need some resolution. Is there an appeal process that I'm not aware of?
Yes, Stan, there's a escalation process is the way I would describe it. So the folks that work in the hub or that are kind of talking, interacting with the providers and the recipients work in that function. On a weekly basis, there's a information. Again, this is a lot of narrative information, not statistical information, but like the cases, here's what's going. They go to the plan managers, those that are responsible for the contract. So they can look over what's outstanding. And there's a little flag of what's out. I'm kind of looking for it, obviously. I think it's what's outstanding over 30 days, right? And they have weekly calls with the plans to go over that. So there's an escalation pattern beyond the staff with the agency that are interacting with the provider or the consumer that, again, will be monitoring that or looking to see if there's something stuck in the process.
Stan Whitaker again. I understand that, but let's say that provider who gave me that information to bring forward here today says, listen, I need resolution. Do they call the hub and say, look, guys, I need the next guy up, or do I need the appeal process, or I need a grievance process to move this thing forward? What does that provider need to do in relationship to the hub in order to get resolution for that recipient?
They shouldn't have to do anything, and because of the escalation pattern. Again, if there's a problem with that escalation pattern, we want to fix the escalation pattern. So
I think you should escalate that
to give us the details so that we can look to see that it worked as it should have worked with the escalation.
Thank you.
I'll recognize, before we go back to Dr. Thacker, I'll recognize Ellen Anderson from the Florida Hospital Association. No. I recognize Ellen Anderson from the Florida Hospital Association.
Thank you. Okay. So I'm a Medicaid beneficiary, and I have gone to the website to put in a complaint through the ACA website. Then ACA calls me back. or does ACA reach out to, if it's, you know, associated with the health plan, which, you know, let's, in that scenario, or does it, do they call the health plan and then the health plan calls me back to rectify?
That's a really good question. Agency staff would call the individual, the beneficiary. We are working on some improvements on the website so we could actually capture some more pertinent information, but almost every case we have to get clarification and callback. So we start with actually calling the complainant, even if it's a provider, and then we reach out to the plans.
In that, just a quick follow-up, in that scenario, would then the beneficiary at some point be handed over to the health plan to then, and then take the agency out, or how does that, how does the close to that, you know?
It depends what the issue is. We're assuming that there's an issue with the plan, or says, I didn't get my
prior
handbook,
something,
right? You know, I just got it. And so we would call, make sure we understand typically how it works, the recipient, what is the issue, who's going to make, verify what plan you're in. We can see that in the system, but just make sure we understand the issue. Then we reach out to the plan. This is what the issue is that was presented. They didn't get their member handbook. Send them a handbook.
Mm-hmm.
Then the staff would call the recipient, the beneficiary, back and say, did you get your handbook I talked to? So that's the resolution loop back that we're doing that sometimes adds a little bit of time onto the resolution time.
Amy Kynan, Florida Legal Services.
A real quick basic question, because in our conversation I realized that maybe I wasn't 100% clear on what we're calling the Complaint Operations Center and how a complaint actually gets into the hub. I guess it was my understanding that, of course, people can go through the click the button for a complaint on the website, and then they can also go through the Medicaid field offices, and I believe there's also another toll-free number that you can get through the managed care section of the website, right? So, for instance, I know we've talked about providers calling. Are they using that number, or could they be talking to someone who they're working with at ACA, and could a complaint be triggered or put into the hub that way?
It could. We want you to use the button, and we want you to use the numbers that are on the website. There are a lot of people, and this happened a few times in the last few months, where people call me, and then the problem gets resolved, and I get a ton of credit. I just put it in the hub. Yeah. It ends up even if you call into the area offices, they're entering it onto the computer system for us. They're doing the press a complaint button, and they're entering it in, and it all goes to Deatra Cole, who is the area office manager for us in Region 8 down in Fort Myers, and she's the one that coordinates and tracks, make sure that it goes to the right person in the agency, the right functional unit in the agency to resolve the issue. If they start seeing the same issue over and over again and they're working the same problem and it's Groundhog Day, I've seen this same thing happen with United yesterday in the exact same area, then they can start to identify the patterns. And because it's their functional area, they can take the action necessary to make sure that the problem gets resolved. But we really wanted to make sure, no matter how it comes in, that it goes to the one spot where it can be aggregated, tracked, and followed up upon.
Thanks.
Yeah.
There's no wrong door, though.
There's no wrong door, though. You can call me, and I will take credit for the resolution. I'll recognize there was a
John,
yep.
Yeah, John Moyle. She said this would pick up my voice.
John Moyle had just a couple of questions. Thank you. Can I just make sure I'm understanding how these numbers are sort of related to one another and in the columns? In your column 2, you have the number of issues received within the last 90 days, right?
Yes.
And then number 3 is the number of issues received in December. That's a subset of the 110, right?
Correct.
Okay. And then on columns 8 and 9, the number of issues resolved in the last 30 days, the number of issues pending for resolution. I thought if you added those up, you might get to the number of issues received in the last 90 days, but you don't. So there's some other issues, I guess, that are out there. Where do you put those?
Well, there would be some issues from December that wouldn't be resolved yet, both provider and recipient issues. Again, we look at the median day. What you've got is the median days for resolution. It means that half of those issues take longer. That's not an average. Half of the complaints take longer than that. Half of them take shorter than that. That's what the median is. But some things do take some time to resolve. There may be issues where we have to address it, and it does take some time for us to reach resolution, and it might take longer than 30 days, and they would show up even though they don't show up in the last 30 days. You might have a number of issues pending for resolution that's slightly higher than the number of issues that have been received in the last 30 days, because there may be some that have lingered a little bit.
Okay, and so are you planning, like, because this is good, helpful information, I appreciate you guys letting people make some comments on it. Are you planning on doing like an annual number on this? Because this shows sort of a snapshot in time, but if you aggregate it, I guess you could put it all together on an aggregate, on an annual basis, and see what it would look like. Because to that point, some of them are maybe beyond 30 days, yeah, or not beyond 90 days.
And as David mentioned, there is an escalation process for things that have been pending for a while. This is a report that we share with our federal partner. That will be shared on a monthly basis going forward. We have operational calls with them about how our waiver is functioning, the one that we achieved, that we received federal approval for, and that is in essence the authority for the statewide Medicaid managed care program. And this is a report we want to share it with you guys, talk about it with you guys, and hear from the public on it. But this is something that we discuss at length with our federal partner on a regular basis during our operational calls with them.
And then on all the categories on the back, let's say somebody said, hey, I want to see how many dental issues you're having or how many transportation issues you're having.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the categories are pretty broad. Are there subcategories where you could easily sort in there and go, okay, dental complaints, you know, do a search and find them, or transportation complaints, do a search and find them, or you got to go in and read the narratives on each one?
Easy
is a relative term. You could query. There's a huge amount of information here. The narratives can be very long. They're entered by recipients, or they're entered by providers directly, or sometimes they're entered based on phone conversations where the person is giving a lot of information. And the narratives can be very long. They're filled with protected health information, identifying information. That sort of stuff helps us in terms of trying to resolve the complaint. That being said, you can run a query on it where you could figure out what keywords that were there, and try to identify the dental complaints or complaints by region. Yes.
I'm just trying to understand your system. I assume that gives you pretty good information to know where you may need to look at if you have a problem.
Yeah, there's a couple things. So we kind of distinguish between rollout and then the status quo. Because again, rollout, we were there every day. So someone mentioned like three or four. You know, when we saw two or three or four, you know, issues, similar issues coming in, it was like an echo chamber. I mean, that's out of like 3 million, you know, enrollees are 300,000 in a plan. But if we saw three or four, I mean, it was a big, we were on the phone. So that's kind of was an approach we use in rollout. Literally every day we were reading those narratives as a management team. Okay, what are we going to do about this? As we kind of went through the reorg process and this functional alignment, then we went through, Beth, how would you have like 6 weeks process that we met with the functional groups on a weekly basis to make sure they had picked up the process, again, of reviewing the information as it comes in, understanding what to do with it, kind of how to handle these particular complaints, again, whether they were clinical complaints, network issues, what have you. So it's a little bit different in terms of, I think, you know, how the approach was used, but I think Justin made this point earlier. The folks that are now looking at this kind of see, you know, they experience when there's something going on because they're seeing every single one of them, you know, every single one of that type of issue that's presented to us.
Okay.
Thanks.
Recognize Dr. Payne.
Robert Payne with the FDA. On the bottom of the second page, it talks about community outreach and aggressive marketing. One of the things this
committee has been tasked with has been to evaluate some of the marketing materials that the different companies have put out. And four different times have I received information about the different brochures and so forth that the companies were proposing to put out. And Sue McPhee first, and now Lorraine Campanero was in charge of compiling that. Do you have a feel for if that procedure is now complete, or will there be more mail-outs to come?
It will be an ongoing basis, so we'll tie it to each meeting. We're likely to have some materials based on the plans, what they submit, if they have any additional marketing materials. But it is an ongoing opportunity for them to submit new materials. More intensive as in the early part as we rolled out and they had the initial materials, but there's nothing that would prohibit, you know, changes in materials or new materials from being developed.
Yeah. But their materials do have to be reviewed by the committee before they go out, and if anyone does spot any materials and has some questions on the committee, we'd probably be more likely to recognize it as a committee member if there seems to be some advertising that you haven't seen before. Then it's possible that there's some marketing out there that went out without review by this committee, and that is inappropriate, and we could take contract action for that. So do let us know.
Okay, just a comment about that. I have reviewed the different things that have come out, and I've really been surprised at the number of not so much fallacious statements, but perhaps ambiguous things, and also things that were non-specific. That
these are materials that we reviewed in the committee that you're talking about, or
no,
are things you've seen out in the community?
No, things that were sent to me to review.
Okay.
Materials sent to me to review.
Sure.
And I was surprised at the number of, again, not so much fallacious things, but just unsubstantiated, you know, claims, things that could be misconstrued, and also non-specific things. So I'm glad you're reviewing, because there's a lot of stuff out there that really it could be misleading.
And we did, particularly, we found factual inaccuracies and things like that. It did force the plans to make some changes. We do not like plans making statements about being the best this or the best that, unless there is some sort of specific piece of data that they're pointing to that they could establish that, and I don't know what that would be at this point. We found out there was one plan that said there's a new name for Florida Medicaid, and the name is, and they named their plan. Not true. But we did correct those things. We told them that those would not be were not suitable for going out for public dissemination. So if anyone sees something like that, let us know. Everything does have to come through this committee for review before it can be sent out to the public. We also had some that were reviewed and approved. But subsequently found out that probably a miscommunication. There was a jumping of the gun, and a bus wrap went out with something on it. The committee ended up reviewing it. It was something that was fine, but the bus went out and started driving around, I believe, Miami about a week before the committee reviewed it, and the plan did get into a little bit of hot water for that. So if you see anything that we haven't reviewed or hasn't come up for review yet, let us know. If you start seeing claims and things like that that don't seem to you to be responsible or accurate, it's important to bring it to our attention, because we do have a lot of contract power there.
And is Lorraine Campanero the one that is in charge of that?
Yes. She heads our marketing unit down in Tampa.
Okay. And Dr. Thacker, I think it's back to you, and I apologize.
Oh, no, it's fine.
You had an intermission in your discussion.
Everything has been very pertinent. Thank you. I had a quick question about, and maybe it's not as quick an answer, but however you can answer it, is what do you think the reason for the longer resolution times from the provider standpoint? And I guess the corollary is there something that the providers aren't understanding, or something that needs to be provided to the providers?
No, Dr. Thacker, I think largely it's the nature of the issues. So, again, just a couple examples that I use. I didn't get my member handbook. It's pretty easy for us to get with the plan, get that handbook out there, figure out. These claims are not paying. My claims are getting denied. It's a much more intensive process of working with both parties what's going on, where's the problem, where's the issue, and trying to get it resolved. So I think it's just the nature of the issues that are being presented are so different that it's kind of which is why we kind of split them out.
And a credentialing and billing issue can take some time to work through to figure out exactly what's going on, to David's point. When it comes to a recipient, the issue can sometimes be very straightforward. I need this type of provider. I'm having a little bit of trouble finding it, or I'm not getting prior authorization, and we can jump on that and get it corrected much more quickly. And if it's something like my transportation has not shown up and I need to get to an appointment, we try to get the transportation there that day, and you end up with a very, very quick resolution that we really have to jump on, and you just kind of make the plan, make it happen. And in some payment cases, we can do that as well, where a payment can be made, but it behooves everybody to make sure that ongoing payments can be made, and the provider is set up in the managed care plan system so that the payment process and the prior authorization process goes more smoothly.
So to kind of follow up with that, and this kind of ties into one of our other previous questions, is there a way to tease out those particular provider issues? Maybe we need to formulate a new FAQ, response if we find that, and provide that to the offices, in terms of the billing issue. And I would like to know, are there more issues with pediatrics versus dental versus primary care versus a specialty, and see that broken down a little bit, and then maybe we need to create a new FAQ, sheet to go out.
Yeah, I think, as Justin said, I think to get to some of the information, there's drill downs that we could use. There's some ad hoc analysis. There's some ad hoc drilling. And what we really rely on, again, is now kind of centralizing the staff, so in this case the Fort Lauderdale folks, to kind of highlight us in any, anything they see going on. And so we have had, again, contract compliance actions going out to plans for specific claims payment issue that came through that process, where the hub looked at that and saw that and kind of discover there was, through their ongoing work of resolving it, it looks like there's an issue here. And then, again, as we talked to the plan about it, got to that next level, found out, yes, there was an issue in terms of paying this particular type of, crossover or whatever the case may be, and then took the appropriate contract action. So I think there is an opportunity for us to kind of capture maybe some of that in a little bit more discreet way that could be shared, but hopefully that's, hopefully that's alerting us of where we see, some specific problems beyond the individual instance, but a more kind of pattern of something.
Yeah, and in terms of pattern, one of the things that came to our attention, which was fair, was the number of different credentialing processes at the plants. That became something that was regularly discussed among providers, both doctors, the various therapists out there, ARNPs, dentists, very particularly, the number of credentialing processes. And in response to that, we are developing, and I've talked about it before, the last Medical Care Advisory Committee, we're trying to streamline and come to a single credentialing process. It'll be substantially streamlined by the middle of this calendar year, and we believe it will be a single credentialing process by the end of this calendar year. And that's in response to things that we picked up here, that I'm having trouble getting credentialed with so-and-so. It's been taken forever. I mean, that's the type of complaint that we were seeing from providers, where it's going to the same unit, they're seeing it over and over again, it's Groundhog Day, it's every plan, it's statewide. Again, it's not a huge level. I mean, providers, particularly doctors, are familiar with the idea of having contracts with lots of different Medicare Advantage organizations, lots of different commercial plans, particularly in South Florida and the big metro areas. But it's still something that resonated in terms of a clear improvement and a step forward that we could take. And we're working with the plans to make sure that we can accomplish that without compromising their accreditation processes, because their credentialing is part of their accreditation process.
Quick comment on that, and I appreciate that. I agree with everything you said there. If there's one, when it comes to credentialing these different plans, if there's one thing you could eliminate is fingerprinting. I've been fingerprinted more than Al Capone. and don't want to have to continue to do that. It seems like if I've been in, you know, once and done it for the state, you know, it seems like that ought to transfer to everybody else, right?
Yeah, and that is the point, and that's what we're hoping to get to. And it would be a fingerprinting situation, and this is relatively new. Just nationwide when it comes to dealing with the FBI and getting a full background check across states, is that they, for the longest time, you'd put in your fingerprints and then they'd only check backward. And that meant that there was no automatic process, so that if you leave here today and you rob a bank, and I wouldn't suggest it, but if you did, that would suddenly show up. Because your fingerprints were associated with, and your background check was associated with a new crime, that process called RAPBACK is now a feature of our background screening process, and we are trying to get to one credentialing process. You're credentialed; you don't have to do it again for any other plans, and it lasts a long time. Because if you do commit a crime, that background screening, there's a RAPBACK, and we can see that a doctor that's in our system has been arrested for robbing a bank. So we're trying to get there.
Great, thank you. And this is more along a question for the beneficiaries. And is there an ability to utilize the ombudsman type of scenario where we have ombudsman for HMO issues? So you call a, you know, a hotline, that sort of thing. Do we utilize a program like that?
Ben,
do
you
want
to speak to the LCC?
So we have ombudsman for some specific type things. So there's long-term care facility ombudsman for nursing facilities and ALF. There's an ombudsman for Medicaid pharmaceutical. So those are very specific programs. There's a couple other ways that we haven't mentioned here that recipients can get assistance. First and foremost, the plans have their own complaint and grievance processes that are mandated. Some are informal. Complaint processes, much like our complaint hub, they're supposed to have something very similar. And then there's formal grievance processes. So I think there was questions about escalation. That's another way to escalate. Those formal grievance processes are tracked very carefully. They have specific time frames. So there's a couple different ways that recipients can get help. If they've been denied, a service has been denied, reduced, suspended, or terminated, they get a fair hearing right. They can also go to the subscriber assistance panel, which is for people in managed care, as an alternate route. So there's multiple routes to get additional assistance, but there's not sort of one single ombudsman place.
Stan, you're recognized?
Yes, Stan Whitaker with the Florida Association of Nurse Practitioners. One of the breakdowns that I see on this that you've done, and you guys have done quite a bit of work on that, and I appreciate it. Also, I've gotten a lot of compliments from beneficiaries on the hub system, so don't think I'm beating you guys up here. But, however, the one issue that seems to arise from a few of the regions that have given me feedback is the referral process for the plans. That the referral process, that when they go to refer, that either one of the referral physicians within the plan is no longer accepting, or one of the specialists is no longer in the state of Florida, and that they're going to the plans and their complaint system, like Beth mentioned, and saying, hey, look, you know, this guy says they're not here, we need somebody. And then we're going further and further and further away from region to try and find a provider for those individuals. When it becomes problematic, and then I either get a call and then I tell them to put it in with the hub. So we're trying to go through the plan. They're trying to go through the plans to get this resolved, but there's no resolution because as the plans will say, okay, then you're authorized to go see so-and-so. So you call them up and you go to get an appointment with them and they go, oh, no, we don't take them. So we get this feedback. So we get this difficulty trying to get these people out for referrals. And the one thing I guess what I'm trying to say, to make a long story short, is there any way that we can track difficulty with referrals? as far as that goes, because, like I said, there are some of these referrals that are 2 to 3 months out that haven't gotten resolved.
It is important that that type of information get into the hub. Again, if you could follow up with the specifics of the case, if something wasn't escalated the right way, it's important for us to understand why that happened. So if you could get us the specific cases. Now, if there are network issues, they're generally going to be captured on this sheet under desired provider, not in network or insufficient provider network. That's where they're saying they're having trouble getting the provider that they desired. You can see the plans that have had that issue, and you can see the number of times that those issues have come into our issue and complaint hub in the last month. Some plans have had more trouble than others. I suppose we could do a query and an ad hoc look at what areas it was happening in. It was happening in other in certain areas more than others, but that's the type of thing that we really need to know. We haven't seen a lot of complaints, frankly, around that issue, but everyone matters. The reason that recipient issues are resolved so quickly is because it is incredibly important to us to connect that individual with care as quickly as possible, and we can bring pressure to bear on the plans to make sure that it happens, and the plans want to make it happen. I don't know what the disconnect is in any individual case. It's very large systems that the plans are running as well as what we're running, but they want to connect the people with the care. We want to connect the people with the care, and it's just important that that does come into us. I'll tell you, too, if you have some trouble, even if you do get a resolution to it, but you don't feel like it was quick enough, putting it into the complaint hub is not going to hurt. You can say it was already resolved, but it still ends up as something here that would go to the appropriate unit for them to look at so that they can understand. Because even if it's resolved, but it's resolved late, let's say people are getting appointments with specialists in 65 days instead of 60, and they're getting it, and then they don't complain. Well, that's not in compliance with the contract. And it is important for us to know that. And again, on behalf of all of your patients, whether it's recipients, clients at Florida Legal Services, make sure that word gets out there as practitioners and as providers and as people, as representatives of Medicaid recipients. Just because you had a problem that was resolved, there's no harm in writing into us and letting us know that you had a problem. It helps. Amy Guinan, you're recognized.
Just to follow up on Mr. Whitaker's question, and we've actually had similar issues, and we have worked with beneficiaries in putting them through into the complaint hub. But as I'm looking here, I know we discussed earlier about how it's hard to categorize each one or how to fit one in, but to me this is one of our biggest issues that we are seeing, and it does touch on the provider network adequacy. At the same time, it could also, I see, be a plan gave incorrect information, or it maybe even could be a service issue. And that's the issue of the enrollee pulling up the provider information or the directory online to look for a provider, and the materials are incorrect. So, and it looks like there might not be an adequate provider network in place, but when they contact DACA, they say, or whoever they contact, they say, clearly they do have a network that's adequate in place. But the information right there says not accepting or no provider in the area. So I think there can be a disconnect between the information that you have as with regard to provider networks and what the enrollees are getting, and I'm not sure which category this would fit into.
I think it's important just that it be reported to us. We do try. This is kind of going back to the data point. It's important that not just that you extract data the same way at the same time, but that you aggregate and that you record it in the same way at the same time. So we want our people to act consistently in terms of how they categorize and how they characterize the issue that's come in. When you talk about things like the provider directories, you have a disconnect in time that's very natural. In terms of the printed materials, the plans don't update that every week, and they update that, what, every 6 months? Is that how often they update it? They update every 6 months. When it comes to choice counseling and the provider networks that they put into us, electronically, they come in every week, and they're updated every week. And plans are a work in progress. Some doctors will close their panels to new patients at a certain point in time, and that is not necessarily going to be clear from member materials. New doctors may come into the plan, and that's not going to be reflected in a provider directory that's only updated every 6 months. But it would be clearer if you went into the choice counseling system. You might be able to see that provider is in fact in the network. Just a word about contract requirements. It's important for us to hear these things regardless, because we can tell whether we can contact the plan and figure out whether the doctor is in network or not in network, using doctors as an example. You have very funny situations where sometimes the doctor doesn't even realize he's in network, and then the plan provides us with the contract with the signature page, and you send it to the doctor, and the doctor goes, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I did sign that. There also could be a situation where the provider did close the panel on a certain date, and at the time that the provider directory went out, it was accurate. There are also contract requirements, though, that 95% of the doctors have to be accepting new patients, and we have a contract requirement that the doctors that are listed as in network actually be in the network. Kind of an important thing. It was a focus point of our rollout, was that the people that were choosing their plans were basing it on accurate information, and we did not want to hear stories of people choosing a plan because Dr. Jones was in the network, where Dr. Thacker was in the network, and then Dr. Thacker wasn't in the network when they actually went out and tried to make an appointment with Dr. Thacker, or he wasn't. I'm not taking new patients right now. My panel is closed. We didn't hear a lot of that during the rollout. Thankfully, the plans took that very seriously as one of the major touchstones of what a successful rollout was. We're not hearing about a ton of it now, but every single piece of it is interesting right now, and it's of interest to us from a contract enforcement standpoint. Right now, during rollout, we had so many things going on that when it comes to network issues, we're very focused on complaints right now in terms of reacting to the complaints that we see. As we go forward, we're going to be a little bit more proactive in our network enforcement, not just waiting for complaints to come in, but affirmatively going out and testing the networks ourselves. We're in a pivot stage, a transition stage from rollout to that steady state.
Can I add just to that? Yeah. So we did some of that testing during the rollout, so did some secret shopper in terms of calling, and do you take that. We did it as we responded, and that's one of the benefits of, again, having these go-to kind of dedicated folks. Not only they know how to do that, you know, but they can see. I think maybe I'll probe a little bit further on this one, on this plan, or what have you. It's kind of the trick is, you know, kind of formalizing that, getting that to kind of more proactive, as Justin said. And we did a lot of that. So I mentioned Fort Lauderdale. We created a unit in Tampa as well. So we saw if we had a quality of care issue that really kind of caught the attention of the folks in the quality unit. We deployed folks in the, you know, on the ground to collect information, right, or to really take a look at it, to get attention, to highlight the issue. We did secret shoppers on the marketing, for marketing, in terms of marketing complaints. We did sit both people in to look at records. We actually went out to events. So we've done a lot of new things as part of the rollouts that are really kind of new tools for us. I think have a lot of promise for us to, it won't be the only compliance tool that we do kind of from the complaint hub, but it really presents an opportunity for us to build a lot of our compliance or a lot of additional compliance tools off the real experience of beneficiaries and providers. And that's kind of cool.
Go ahead. I need to follow up.
Just a couple things come to mind.
Sure.
Definitely, we want to make sure that we're advising enrollees to go to the place where the most up-to-date directories are. But you mentioned choice counseling, and I think at this point, most enrollees have gone through the choice counseling process, correct? So when they're trying to get information, they're going to be going to their plans. And the first step, I believe, and I think even on the, well, I know on the
managed care section of the statewide managed care section of the ACA website, you have a place where you can click to go to provider directories, and that actually takes you to a different format for each plan. And some plans may take you to a place where you can download a PDF of a directory, and it may be 2 months old. But some plans also have something that you can put in the specialist that you want, and I've assumed that would be the most up-to-date directory, but that is what we were seeing where the problems were, where there were no.
It's important for us to know that. Were those entered into the hub?
Yes. Okay. And so then the follow-up question with that, and I know I do really appreciate the idea of the secret shopper, and I think that's something that the beneficiaries can help you with as well. So
you guys are allowed to do it, too, if you want. Anybody can do it.
And we intend to.
Report the problem.
So as the complaint came in, then the enrollee, I'm speaking as an example, the enrollee was contacted by you or the plan to say, oh, no, that's incorrect. We definitely have providers. Here's the list. I guess what I want to clarify with you is then should the enrollee or whoever's making the complaint go back into the hub again and say, yes, this was resolved for the beneficiary, but what is ACA doing to make sure that this plan is fixing their directory search guide or make sure that they have the right information in their directory.
I think that's a situation where even though it may have been resolved to the enrollee's satisfaction, that letting us know that it happened would still be important. And so going into the complaint hub and saying, this has been resolved, but this is what I went through. And we would categorize it and someone would read it and it helps us see the patterns.
Okay, thanks.
Dr. Payne. Oh, sorry. Ms. Pierce, you're recognized. And then Dr. Payne.
I would like to know if there's been any different way of getting the new providers. Is it the plan's responsibility to get their own providers? I was told in the past that Medicaid does not solicit providers, that the providers have to solicit Medicaid to be a provider.
Yeah.
Has that changed?
The health plans do build their own networks, and in addition to that, we have providers under contract with us. Both of those things happen. When it comes to providing, if you're a managed care plan, and I'll use Humana as an example, they build their own provider network, and they have their own doctors under contract with them, and they have a credentialing process to make sure the doctors have the credentials, and they need to have enough doctors in their network and under contract with them to serve their population. Those doctors don't have to have a direct contract with us or be enrolled with us. They have to register with us because we have to know they're in the network, and that's a data issue, that we have to know the service, and we get to see the services that they provide. When they submit bills to the plans submit those to us so that we know that that doctor is active in the network and is seeing patients and is providing these services. But they don't have to have a formal contract with us anymore. We thought, and this was interesting, we thought that as a result of switching to managed care, fewer providers would directly enroll with us and enter into contracts with us to be a fee-for-service provider for us, because there's not much of a fee-for-service population, that they would instead just enter into a contract with their managed care plan and register with us. And we had anticipated as part of our reorg that we would need fewer provider enrollment people. Lo and behold, most of the plans, and we have seen an uptick in provider enrollment in our program, both in managed care and in fee-for-service, they are often insisting that providers directly enroll with us as a prerequisite to being in their panel. And we've seen a workload increase on our provider enrollment staff, not a decrease, which was something of interest to us. And it's also helped make up our mind about a single credentialing process as well. I mean, if we have to do it anyway, we might as well start doing it where it's not repeated over and over and over again. I don't know if I answered your question, but that, in essence, the plans themselves are the ones that build the provider networks and enter into the contracts with providers.
Okay, on the fee for service.
Yes.
Does Medicaid contact a provider, or they still have to have the provider still has to contact Medicaid that they want to participate in the program? The reason the question comes up is we have one hearing aid dealer in Duval County, one. And they were about to drop the plan completely because none of their bills were being paid. And I just happened to find that out because I took my son in for an appointment, and she said, by the way, we will not be providing his next hearing aids because we're no longer going to work with Medicaid. We can't get paid.
And that's being paid in the fee-for-service system.
Yes. So I contacted Carla, and she put me in touch with someone to get it. In other words, all of their claims were being denied.
Okay.
No follow-up, just denials. And so they were just going to drop the program. They couldn't get paid, and they weren't, you know, interested. And there's no other provider in Duval County, as big as that county is.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, does Medicaid intend to try to contact any other provider to make that service available? They did get it resolved. They did send someone over to work with them on getting their claim submitted properly, and that was the problem. But nobody bothered to contact them. They just kept denying the claims until I brought this in because it was going to be dropped. And I just, if they're constantly being denied, why doesn't someone follow up and say, this is what you're doing wrong, instead of losing a provider because you didn't give them any help?
Boy, I'd have to. I don't really know a lot about that situation. I'd like to understand it a little bit better and more completely. I would assure any provider that if they're having trouble getting paid, not to wait for us to call them. If they're getting the claims denied, they can call us. We will immediately look into it and research the issue to try to figure out what the disconnect may be. What error is going in terms of the claims form, or what error is happening in our system that's preventing them from getting paid? We're always interested in that information. We do try to maintain provider networks, and we have been able to piggyback off of, if you will, the plans in recent months and in the past year. In terms of building our own provider network, because so many of the plans are asking the providers that they're signing up and bringing new to the program to go ahead and enroll directly with us. And then they can bill us fee for service.
At one time, there were like four or five providers in Duval County, but now we have just one.
Yeah.
And so if they drop plans, we won't have anybody. And I just wondered, is Medicaid going to do anything about that?
Yeah. We'll have to look into that situation.
I've got a follow-up on that.
Dr. Thacker, you're recognized? Just first. Dr. Payne, you're recognized. Sorry.
I am a Payne, yes.
Yeah.
What you and David said about investigating the accuracy of the provider networks is music to my ears. I'm very happy that you intend on doing that, have been doing that, and will continue to do that. Because it's been my experience in the past that some of these network roles have been wildly inaccurate. You know, people on there that perhaps see healthy kids but don't do Medicaid in another form. People there who have retired. People there who are deceased. You know, just on and on. And I'm glad you recognize that the insurance companies need to be checked up on as far as the accuracy of their roles in their networks, and not be depended on to give you entirely accurate roles. Thank you. I'm glad you're doing that.
Yeah. And then Chris Snow from the audience.
Okay, still working.
Oh, look at that.
Actually, not directly.
You brought that yourself?
No, somebody else did.
Just teasing.
Down? Okay. Is that
you
good?
Just walk around right. With a lavalier. Yeah.
No, I'm really not that technology savvy for sure. but to kind of follow up on that lady's comment, but more generally, and we kind of talked about this, I did in a meeting I had with Beth. So say you have a complaint about, say, non-emergency Medicaid transportation, because that's just fee-for-service. Do we use the same avenue through the complaint button, or is that not going to be able to address those issues because those folks, a lot of them are more focused on the plans?
You can use the same avenue.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. And a comment is that I
the numbers here are just for SNC.
Right, but you get other complaints. Okay, good. That's the same mechanism. Okay. And I do want to say that, and you guys have talked about a little bit recently, that the management information component of this system, of y'all kind of being able to identify a problem that's maybe a little bit higher level than one particular recipient, I've seen that work. Not that every issue's been resolved already, but these are bigger issues. So I appreciate that you guys have that built in and are using that to help
go get at some of the bigger, more pervasive issues. So, thanks.
We do escalate it, and we have been able in some cases, and I think you were involved in one where we were able to get several members of the health plans executive teams to meet with provider groups and a provider association to sit down and try to iron out the problems. And we did something similar with the rural hospitals, actually, when there was an issue around labs in rural hospitals. And we're able to start that dialogue and, I believe, resolve quite a few of the problems. Again, sometimes change is difficult and people have to make adjustments. But in many cases, if a dialogue is started, then the issues can be ironed out. And we do escalate. Anything else? Okay. With that, sure. I guess one last thing is there anyone on the phone that has any questions about the discussions that we've been having? All right. With that, I will mention that the next meeting. Do you want to do this, Carla? Or the next meeting is tentatively scheduled for April 14th of 2015, right before tax day. Make sure you get those filed. With that, we will go ahead. Yeah. With that, we will adjourn the Medical Care Advisory Committee. There are going to be breakout sessions for the subpopulation committees. So if you're on one of the subpopulation committees, now is the time to go to the breakout sessions.